Welcome to Revitalize and Replant with Mark Clifton, where we equip pastors to take their churches from declining to thriving by pointing them to a new future and a new hope. Join us weekly for encouragement and practical advice in your pastoring journey.
Well, here we are again with a special episode, and this time we are continuing our talk with Dr. Jeff Chang, who serves as assistant professor of church history and historical theology and the curator of the Spurgeon Library. And in our last episode, we spent a lot of time talking about the person of Spurgeon. Fascinating stuff. And we're going to continue with that and talk about a lot of his ministry aspect and find ways that we can actually not only connect with it, but identify certain elements of our ministry that maybe need improvement. Or maybe we can thank the Lord that he's leading us in a good direction. So, Mark, say hello to Dr. Chang.
Dr. Chang, thank you for being here. As I said last time we were together, if you didn't listen to this, the earlier one, just go back and you'll find it there on your podcast platform. Listen to the first one with Dr. Chang and us. We are here at Alpharetta at the North American Mission Board. Dr. Chang is kind enough to come and lead a conference for us down here, and so Dan and I are here for that. So, even though we all three live in Kansas City, and by the way, a few months ago, we actually did the podcast in the Spurgeon Library.
Right.
And it's Spurgeon's podcast studio. Who knew you had a Victorian podcast studio?
It's amazing. I think we sat in a chair.
I think he was the first one to have one there. So anyway, but we used the Spurgeon podcast studio. But here we are in Alpharetta, and if you missed the last one, go back and listen to it. We talked a lot about Spurgeon's conversion. His initial preaching as a teenager, very interesting. Had no idea he preached that many sermons as a teenager, and that those sermons now have been discovered, and Dr. Chang has put those together. We'll put that in the show notes. You can actually purchase those yet before unpublished sermons of Charles Spurgeon, and then how he got to New Park Street and how New Park Street transferred and became the Tabernacle. And so I want to back up for just a minute, Dr. Chang, and talk about the library itself. What is it? How did you get it? What's it look like? If people, and listen, if you are anywhere near Kansas City, go to the Spurgeon Library.
Yes.
I mean, you're only 20 minutes from the airport or something.
Right.
It's pretty close, very convenient, easy to get to. It is really worth going to. So talk to him about the library.
Yeah. So, Spurgeon dies in 1892. After his death, kind of in the new century, his family is trying to figure out what to do with their father's kind of remains. And as far as his library goes, they give some books to the Pastor's College. They give some books to the Baptist Union. But the heart of it is still all together. And so the family puts out a notice saying that Spurgeon's books can be purchased. And surprisingly, they're not able to find a buyer. I have a letter from a pastor in London writing to the president of Southern at that time, E.Y. Mullins, who had expressed interest in that library. And the pastor in London said, hey, don't waste your money. This library is only made up of kind of the old puritanical stuff. It's got none of the new modern stuff. It's nearly worthless. You know, save your money for something better. I think that letter expresses the theological shift that has taken place there in the UK.
I think it probably does. You're right.
However, the Missouri Baptists in that day were still conservative. They still love the gospel. They love Spurgeon.
Right.
And when they heard that those books could be purchased, they sent over an agent to make an offer. Supposedly, they raised the money for it like in an hour at their annual meeting.
Right.
They sent over an offer, and they immediately were accepted. And so in 1905, those books were purchased. 1906, they were shipped to America. And they landed at William Jewell College, which was the Missouri Baptist sort of training seminary of the day. And those books resided there at William Jewell for about a century until 1906. Mm-hmm. By 1906, William Jewell has sort of shifted to
2006.
Become, 2006, sorry. 2000.
They 2006. Came in 1906.
They came in 1906. In 2006.
And it is kind of a neat story, too. Missouri Baptist Convention was in session when they got the cable from the agent, I think, and said, this is, you know, it would cost this much. And so in session, they got excited and they approved the money.
That's right. Yeah.
And if they're going to ship him back to Missouri, there's only one college, William Jewell.
Right.
That's where it should go.
That's right.
So it stayed there for 100 years. Dan and I went to William Jewell, and it was down in the basement of the library. Mm-hmm. In fact, I got to be honest with you, because I went right from high school to college, and I was like, you know, working on the radio and playing around and trying to, you know, I didn't even know it was there for the first 2 years. Had no idea. And then when I found out it was there, it was like, Oh, okay. You know, I didn't really know who Spurgeon was, really was. I mean, kind of knew, but not really. And that was sort of the way at Jewel. The most people, unless you were a historian, you couldn't even get to the place. It was downstairs. Yeah. And
it was all locked up.
It was all locked up and that kind of thing. So so then, 2006, what happens?
Well, boy, there's just so much we could say about that story about
interest
in Spurgeon in the, in the 20th century. So, yeah, I mean, you're exactly right. Spurgeon was largely forgotten in the 20th century.
Yeah,
right?
1960s, 70s, when in 70s when Dan and I went to college there, nobody was talking about Spurgeon, really, that I knew of.
Yeah, but thanks to Banner of Truth, thanks to Pilgrim Publication, thanks to sort of this revival within evangelicalism for kind of good Reformed theology.
And Puritan theology.
And Puritan theology.
For sure.
Spurgeon really has had an amazing comeback, one might say, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, but by 2006, William Jewell has transitioned to being not so much a seminary, but more of a kind of liberal arts college.
Very liberal arts college. And actually, I think had removed itself as associated with the Missouri Baptist Convention any longer. So it was no longer part of the Missouri Baptist Convention and basically just a liberal arts college. Right.
So there wasn't as much of a place for the Spurgeon Library in their collection. So it was put up for auction, and Midwestern won the auction. So Midwestern Seminary in 2006, thanks to—
I wonder if Southern bid against them. Do you have any idea?
I know that Southwestern bid against
them. It'd be interesting since E.Y. Mullins passed on it 100 years before, if Dr. Moeller missed it.
I'm sure he wishes that— But the library was there, I'm sure.
So Midwestern got the— – and it was really cool because William Jewell is like 10 miles from Midwestern.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, people would think, oh, they just gave it to Midwestern because it's down the street. No, Midwestern had to bid, they won the bid.
That's right.
And literally it was just down the street.
Yeah.
But it is no longer in a basement.
No, that's right. So it came over to our campus in 2006, and thanks to Dr. Allen. You know, at that time, Midwestern, 2006, people weren't sure whether it was going to make it or not as a seminary.
Many people thought it wouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
It was in some really— – I was a chairman of the Alumni Association. It was in a really challenging place.
Yeah, that's right.
Today, it is unbelievable what's happened at that school.
Yeah.
It is one of the biggest success stories in Southern Baptist life. But part of that is the library. So go ahead.
Part of that is the library, yeah. And there, I mean, in so many ways, the Spurgeon Library represents Dr. Allen's vision for the seminary. I mean, he, a love for the church, a strong foundation in Reformed Baptist kind of convictions, and just a beautiful work there on the campus of the
school. So if you ever went to Midwestern in the past, and my dad graduated from there, the old chapel was a box.
Mm.
It was just a square box, literally, with a tile floor. All the other seminaries had beautiful chapels, but Midwestern, we always just had this square box. In fact, normally our graduations were not held in the chapel. We were across the street at some other church or someplace, you know. But when they finished the chapel under the leadership of Dr. Allen, they took the new chapel. They took the old chapel, which was just a large square box, and they transformed it into the most amazing library for Spurgeon's books and memorabilia and a place to study and to gather. I'm telling you, it is stunning when you walk in there. Talk to him about what the library contains, both its books, also its artifacts.
Oh, yeah. So in terms of its books, I mean, that's the showpiece, right? 6,000 volumes of Spurgeon's pastoral library. So these are books that he owned, he worked with. These were the tools of his ministry. A lot of these books have his inscriptions, his annotations. So that's kind of the key component of the Spurgeon Library. But on top of that, we just have a growing collection of all kinds of artifacts, things from his life and ministry, letters, manuscripts of his sermons.
Personal effects. Doorknob of his office.
That's right. The thing people like the most are his smoking implements.
Well, that's true. All his smoking implements always got a lot of attention. But there are some of the things he had, personal things. But you've developed a close relationship with his family, correct?
We have, yeah. They came down when we dedicated the space. We definitely have a relationship.
Right, and they're very much in favor of what's going on.
Absolutely.
Look, it's a great place to spend some time. There's some beautiful paintings of Spurgeon, some great murals of his life that describe his life there. Some information about his wife.
Mm-hmm.
I had a friend of mine who was at Brass Armadillo, right? That's that flea market. Mm-hmm. And there was some little letters to my students' books. And so he bought them and he gave them. And he, to my surprise, still have them. she had autographed each one of them. She herself, and of course, there they were selling them. The brass armadillo didn't know that Mrs. Spurgeon. But inside, she had written handwritten notes to all. Yeah. I have those.
Yeah, yeah.
If you'd like to barter with them, I could. I do.
If you'd like to donate them, we'll.
We might. By the way, I also have a whole stack of sword and trowels. An older pastor died and gave them to me. My wife said, "What are you going to do with those?" And I can't throw them away.
No, you can't.
They're really cool. I'll let you take a look at them. So go to the Spurgeon Library. Do you have hours? Is it open just, is it kind of whenever? How's that work?
Yeah, when school's in session, we're open 11 to 4:30, so kind of spring and fall.
Okay.
Winter and summer. Just send us an email, and we'll figure out a way to get you in.
I would. It's really worth it. You mm-hmm. might even want to take some people there. And also seeing the whole campus, everything's going on in Midwestern. It's a great thing to
that's
see.
That's right. We love hosting church groups. We love hosting Bible studies. So bring a group out. We'll give you a nice 30-minute tour, and then you can spend another 30 minutes looking around the library and then look around campus.
And you can stand on his preaching rail and get your picture taken like everybody does.
That's right.
So it's pretty cool. It is. All right. So I want you to talk with us, the time we have remaining, about Spurgeon as he took the New Park Street Church and what it was before he got there, and then the transitions it went through and how that looked. Spurgeon as a church revitalizer.
Yeah. New Park Street Chapel, 1850s, it was a struggling church. Now, historically, it was a very significant church among Baptists. They had kind of this prestigious pedigree. Some of the most famous Baptists of their day had once been their pastors. So men like Benjamin Keach, he was big-time theologian, one of the signers of the 1689 Confession. John Gill, probably the greatest Baptist theologian that's ever lived. He was their pastor for 50 years. And then after Gill, John Rippon, a famous hymn writer, preacher, revivalist, kind of evangelist, he pastored for 63 years, that congregation.
Really?
So there was this amazing pedigree, which, if you've ever worked in church revitalizing, that can be a benefit, but it can also be a drawback.
So how old was Spurgeon when he first went there?
Well, he was 19 years old.
Yeah,
he's showing up at this church with this amazing history. And people are comparing him to the previous pastors, comparing him to Rippon.
Now, was he married to Susanna yet?
No, at that point, he's single.
Okay.
He's living as a bivocational minister in Water Beach. But they call him. He moves to London. Like I said, the church was dying when he shows up. It was a massive building that could seat 1,500. There were about a half dozen, about 30 people there.
Really?
His first Sunday.
I had no idea it was that bad.
Yeah, it was that bad. It's interesting. I found a letter from one of the deacons at the New Park Street writing to the Baptist Union, letting them know that in the previous year, they hadn't made a single addition.
Wow.
Not a single convert.
And that's where Spurgeon went.
And the following Sunday, Spurgeon shows up to fill the pulpit. And he's asking, the deacon had written, "Pray for us." And somebody must have been praying.
And he came just to fill the pulpit, not to be the pastor.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. The church was in a terrible location. He talks about how when the deacons, Rippon was the was kind of the previous significant pastor. In the 60th year of his pastorate, the church was forced to find a new location because London sort of needed to demolish their old building to build a thoroughfare. So with this old pastor, they find this terrible location. Spurgeon says, if they were trying to ruin the church, they couldn't have found a better spot.
Yeah. Well, there's some guys listening right now whose churches are like that.
Yeah.
I was working with a church recently in Kansas City who was actually on a dead-end street.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, literally. It was literally on a dead end. You couldn't even see it.
You had to pay a toll to cross the bridge to get to this church.
Is that right?
To get to Spurgeon's church. I mean, it was built next to like a vinegar factory.
I did not know that.
There are all kinds of factors contributing. Like, that's why this church was in huge decline.
Okay.
And yet, the Lord did something amazing.
Right.
Yeah.
So New Park Street, he was in that building for how long?
So for 7 years.
Okay. And it grew to what?
Yeah. So it... By the time they transition to the Metropolitan Tabernacle, membership is probably around 1,500.
Okay.
Yeah.
So a lot of that conversion, probably?
Yes. Yeah, so he begins to preach. He's preaching the gospel for whatever reason. I think because of his sort of reputation that he's gaining around London, this kind of boy preacher.
Right.
People are very curious. And people who perhaps would have never gone to church are coming out to hear this country preacher. And a lot of these people are unchurched. So you can tell that these are conversions because when you look at the minute books, especially these in these early years, something like 90% of the people joining the church are being baptized.
Wow.
So this is not transfer growth.
Right.
No, these are people hearing the gospel and being converted for the very first time.
So at this time, the building is limited by the number of people that can seat. So this is when he's doing some preaching in other venues on Sunday nights and so forth.
That's right.
And that wasn't well received by some of the Baptist Union folks, was it?
No, yeah, or even by the press, you know. So for him to preach at Exeter Hall, that was a building that seated 3,000. People felt like, man, what's up with this kid
right.
with the audacity to preach in such a large place? And then he preaches in the music hall, which is seats 10,000.
Right.
And yet, what's striking is, you know, people who would otherwise not have ever walked into a church building, they feel more comfortable going into a venue like a music hall, and it seats 10,000. So you know, there's plenty of room for them.
So London at the time, you said it was at the height, really, of the Victorian age, the height of Britain's power. But London was a city with a lot of problems, a lot of issues, a lot of, of poverty, a lot of crime, a lot of what we would call social justice needs. How was he involved in that?
Well, his congregation was mostly made up of kind of middle class to lower middle class. And so he had people who worked in the factories. He had people who worked in shops. So he was very aware of the needs of kind of the common person, the injustices that they faced. The Industrial Revolution was very hard. It made the poor poorer. It made the rich richer. And so Spurgeon was outspoken towards those refined gentlemen who would show up to worship on a Sunday, but then during the week would grind the faces of the poor in order to make a buck. One of his best sermons was a sermon he preached after the mutiny to India in 1859. And there he preached before an audience of 23,000 in the Crystal Palace. And if you can find that sermon in his volume of sermons, and there he calls out sort of all the injustices of his day, for those who are, again, taking advantage of the poor.
I knew he had done that. I don't think people realize how much he cared about people like that. And it came across, in much of what he did.
He was outspoken against slavery in America.
Oh, yeah. You know? Very, very much
when
so.
He found out that his editors were taking out his comments on slavery in America, you know, when Americans were republishing his sermons, he made sure that they put it back in, and that lost them a lot of sales.
Yeah, and he was controversial, incredibly controversial for those reasons and for many others. So anyway, New Park Street, and then talk about transitioning over to the Tabernacle. What happened there?
Well, for him, one might think, well, he just needed more seats. You know, he needed a bigger building. I think for Spurgeon, at the heart of it was a theological issue. He realized he couldn't pastor this amorphous congregation, lots of attenders showing up to this music hall, 10,000 people. He wanted to be the pastor of a church. It pained him that there were now more members of his church than could fit in the building that they owned, which meant that as a church, they could not sit down to the Lord's Supper together.
Oh, okay.
And if you don't take the Lord's Supper together, how can you be a church?
So let's get a little controversial here. So Spurgeon didn't feel like he should have a Saturday night service and three services on Sunday morning.
No, he didn't.
And then
there's no multi-site, no video projections.
We're going to have multi-site services. Yeah. And
despite the podcast booth, he did not go that route.
Yeah, the podcast booth, the only thing he had. No. So that's, I just wanted to put that out there. He could have had four or five services a week in that, even on that day, he could have preached multiple services. But he wanted the whole church family to gather together, and especially communion, to sit at the Lord's table all at one time.
Yeah.
And that was one of the main motivations for him building that building.
He even contemplated, look, God has given me such a powerful preaching ministry. Should I just become an evangelist?
Well, yeah, you would think
that,
right?
Go be a missionary.
Right? Yeah,
go to China, preach to the people there. But his elder said, no, the Lord has called you to be a pastor, right? So they worked with the congregation to build this amazing 6,000-person building, and he was a pastor for the rest of his ministry.
And he did some other things. Talk about the college and the orphanage, for example.
Yeah, so from early on, 1854, 55, a young man came to Spurgeon saying, hey, I want to preach. Spurgeon sends him out to preach in the streets. People in his congregation are concerned because this young man has never received an education. The young man says, I'm going to preach unless you cut off my head. And so Spurgeon thought, well, we can't cut off his head. So let's give him an education so he can learn how to preach. And so he takes him under his wing. His name was T.W. Medhurst. And from there, he just begins to take on young men. One year, two, another year. Before you know it, he's got 16 young men training with him. He covers all their tuition. He covers all their living expenses. By 1861, because of the drop of the sales of his sermons in America due to his comments on slavery, he thinks, well, that effort is done because I can't afford to train these guys anymore. But at that point, the congregation says, no, we're going to adopt your ministry. We're going to make this the Metropolitan Tabernacle College. And that's what it became. So from 1861, it became known as the Tabernacle College or the Pastor's College. And from then on, he would regularly be training 20, 30, 50, you know, 100 students a year, again, covering all their tuition, all their expenses. It really made possible for men of lower class who were gifted to preach but had no means to get an education to be able to get the training.
I don't think we fully understand in the United States, Victorian England, and if you were of a certain class, you weren't ever going to go to school.
That's right.
Ever.
Yeah.
And so this was really something different
That's
to give
right.
them that opportunity.
That's right.
And even though he didn't do multi-site and multiple services, he was very passionate about planting new churches.
He was, yes.
And he was sending these guys out to plant new congregations or to whatever God would do with them, right?
Yeah, and it's no surprise. I mean, with his popularity growing, people loving his sermons, when a Baptist church was looking for a pastor, they'd write to Spurgeon. You know, hey, do you have anybody? Right. And so he was constantly making recommendations. He wasn't, you know, placing men in churches. He was still a Baptist. He's still a Congregationalist.
Right.
But he would gladly recommend certain men. He would say to certain men, oh, you need to wait longer.
This is not a direct quote, but I remember reading something where he talked about these young men who went out. He said, if you'll go out and hang on by the skin of your teeth or hang on, I'll keep you in bread, I'll keep you in cheese. In other words, he did what he could to keep them alive, but they had to work at it and be bivocational and scrap and everything else.
That's right.
But he did keep them in food and kept them going.
Yeah.
And I think one time he said, talking about all the churches he was planting, and I think he said, you could ring the tabernacle with churches, and that would be fine with me.
Yeah.
So he wasn't trying to be territorial about this.
No,
he was very
no.
passionate about planting churches.
Well, often when he would send out men from his church to pastor or to plant, he would send a good chunk of his congregation with them.
Right.
You know, so 30, 40, 50 members. I think I found one church plant where they sent out as many as like 120 members.
And didn't he encourage – I believe he encouraged some of his more middle-class church members who had some means to fund a Sunday school, to buy material and go out and start a Sunday school among children or something along those lines and
that's
fund
right.
it themselves. He was very outwardly focused.
Mm-hmm.
And which brings me to the orphanage.
Mm.
So what do you know about that?
Yeah, so 1867, I think, Spurgeon receives a letter. There's a rich widow of an Anglican who writes to him saying, "You know, I want you to use my sort of inheritance to start something."
Mm-hmm.
And Spurgeon goes and meets with her, you know, something like, oh, thank you for this check for 10,000. And she says, no, I thought I wrote 100,000.
Yeah.
And he thought, I was just afraid that you put an extra zero. But no, it really was whatever that 100,000 amount. So with that, he just, with his heart for the lost, heart especially for the poor children all throughout London, he begins first an orphanage for boys, then an orphanage for girls. And out of that, you know, hundreds of children are rescued from the streets. Many of them go on to profess faith, join the church. In one of our paintings in the Spurgeon Library, we show how the orphans sat at the best seats in the Metropolitan Tabernacle, closest to Spurgeon. You know, the way like a pastor's family sits up front, close to the pastor?
Yeah.
He put the orphans near him because they were his family, you know. And he was sort of their benefactor, their father, really.
That's great.
Some of the most touching stories about Spurgeon's ministry come from his work with orphans, just because you see just his tender heart for the poor.
Jeff, we could go on. You and I could go on and on and on for hours upon hours.
Yeah.
And I just thank you for your commitment. I thank you that God has called you to this very important place. As you said, God has really, he's just given Spurgeon a whole new life. Today, here we are in Alpharetta, 250 pastors here learning about Christ in his church. I got a young man from Florida named Nick who is leading our worship. You know, Nick's, you know, like 12, 14, I don't know. They all look young to me. He's probably a little older than that.
That's a pretty insignificant beard for a
12-year-old. Yeah, that's true. But he's definitely a young man, no doubt about it. And when he ended his worship thing this morning, he ended by reading a prayer from the Valley of Vision.
Yeah.
Now, I'm going to tell you, when Jan and I were in our late teens, early 20s, we were not reading the Valley of Vision. I mean, something has happened, and I'm grateful for it. God is really raising up a generation of men who value theology and value orthodoxy in a world that has none. And Spurgeon is front and center in that. It's so exciting to see Spurgeon have such an influence on a whole other generation.
Amen.
So thank you for what you do. Check out the show notes and find out where you can get these books. Actually, I do have the whole set. I got the whole set of his unpublished sermons. So, you know, how many sermons did he preach before he was 19? What did you say?
689.
689. Someone asked me one time in 40 years how many sermons I preached. I said three. I just kind of keep reusing them over and over. Anyway, with that, we'll call it a day.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. Thank you, Dan.
Thanks for joining us today on Revitalize and Replant. This podcast is brought to you by the North American Mission Board, where we help dying or struggling churches regain health for the glory of God and the good of their communities. If you found this conversation helpful, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast on your favorite platform. To learn more about becoming a replanting pastor or to explore resources about revitalization for your own church, visit churchreplanters.com.